Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty for a gentleman with over 20 years experience in the real estate world, the president of the Realtor Association here in Sarasota, Florida, Tony Barrett of Barrett Realty. Tony, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really happy to have you. I know you've got a lot of experience and a vast swath of knowledge. And normally I like to try to press rewind in the beginning and say, you know, how'd you get into this and kind of walk us through this. But being that you have such a deep experience with this and a broad knowledge in this, and the real estate world is a little bit contentious at the moment, and there's a lot of changes going on, I'm really curious how you feel about the way things have always been and the way it looks like things are becoming.
Well, I don't know that things have always been the same way.
Yeah.
I think what we've always evolved in real estate. Real estate is ever changing. Back in the beginning, when people started in real estate, they used to have to go to the office and pick up keys to go and open houses. And, you know, the lockboxes have changed that concept now. Also, there was a book that was distributed before computers, and they used to have to come and look through the book and find which listings were out there. So we've always been evolving into something better to provide better quality customer service.
But so much of the structures, well, I mean, I understand that the interest rate thing, that's always changed. And though it seems quite high now, I know historically it's been even higher. But what about the hot button issue with the commissions for agents now?
Well, that's a can of worms right there.
Yeah.
We've, there was a case that started in I think it was up in the Midwest. It was the Burnett case. And so back October 31st, 2023, there was a trial, and the jury found that there was an antitrust violation. So since that point, there have been so many copycat lawsuits that have popped up, even in the state of Florida at this time. So it's all about antitrust, and it's all about price fixing. And I don't know. I mean, most of the general public really wasn't aware of what the realtors really do.
Right.
Right. So we, at this point, need to refocus on what our value is as a real estate professional. And I think that the general public is asking for transparency. They're looking at, hey, how do you guys get paid? Because most times, buyers and sellers don't know. Well, the seller knows what the commission is because we've negotiated it with them in the very beginning, and we don't have any kind of fixed or standard type of commission rates. It's broker specific. It's whatever their business model is. So when the buyer gets to the closing table, they see a ALTA statement, a closing statement, and then at that point they see what the buyer's commission was. I think that it would be very helpful in the future if everybody knew where the money was going prior to the closing.
So you think that's it? It's the last second thing?
It could be. I mean, commissions have always been negotiable. That's been a thing from the very beginning. You know, we're the most ethical association, I think, on the planet for sure, because since 1916, we've abided by a strict code of ethics.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about that, because I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand, what it means to be part of a realtor association and why that was necessary from the get-go, because this legitimacy has been baked in for quite a while.
Right, and so you go to a 63-hour course and you get your real estate license. You know, we could talk about the barrier to entry at some point, but that's a whole different topic.
Yeah.
And probably another hour.
Right.
But what we have to see here is that after you graduate and you get your real estate license, then you join a brokerage, and that brokerage is either part of a board of realtors, which is, local, state, and national. Mm-hmm. And if you're part of the National Association of Realtors, then you are a realtor. So that's, that's something that people don't really identify. And that's kind of the mothership of the whole thing.
Okay.
Is that they have code of ethics, and the code of ethics has to do with fair dealings with the public and fair dealings with our people that we collaborate with, other realtors. So that's been in place, and you know, we've seen an uptick now in complaints on realtors, and you know, we handle them all appropriately. It's either you violated the code of ethics or you didn't, and then there's consequences for that.
So what do you think attributes to that uptick? Do you think this is a sort of thing that's kind of been going on, and now everybody's kind of, for want of a better way to put it, kind of turned themselves into a bit of a Karen if they need to, or this sort of thing has just become a more pervasive behavior?
No, I just think that there's more and more people coming into the industry, and that training and professionalism is very key. You know, I was a firefighter paramedic for 30 years. I retired from that.
Awesome.
When I became a paramedic and I graduated and I got my paramedic license, nobody told me all the things that weren't in the book. Mm. You know, all the things that are really job specific and job related. And so it's the same thing with real estate. Once you get out, you really need a good mentor. You need somebody to coach you, to teach you how to operate and do the right thing. And sometimes they're just, you know, these code of ethics complaints are minute. And, you know, some people are just trying to be very helpful at things. You know, specifically, if I was somebody that was coming to your house and I was going to list your property, and I looked at your roof and I said, you know, it's the new law, you know, with insurance companies says that you have a 15-year roof, then you have to provide at least information that says that you have 5 more years of life in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't do that. So, because that's out of my scope.
Right.
I'm not a roofer.
Yeah.
Right? But there have been people that, because they know that this has happened in the past, have said that roof will probably have to be replaced. We you know, we might only be able to accept a cash deal. They're speaking outside of their scope of practice.
Okay.
And you know, it's just a little bit of misfortune. But then there's the stuff that's egregious, and you know, you're going, I don't understand how you even thought that this was ethical at all. So there's, you know, in every industry, there might be a few bad players.
Oh, of course.
But the majority of the people that are realtors are, you know, they're held to a higher standard. Of course, everybody's held to a higher standard, but they do the right thing every day for their customers.
And that's the line between being an actual realtor and not just a real estate agent who's not part of a realtor association?
Right. If you're not part of the National Association of Realtors, then you do not, you're not bound by the code of ethics.
Gotcha.
So there are companies out there that are not part of that association, so they don't have to, they're not bound by the code of ethics. So that's why when you're out shopping for somebody, you know, you want to have somebody that's the most professional and the most ethical. And I'm not saying that a regular agent is not ethical, nor do they follow their own strict ethical codes.
Right.
But, you know, at least you know you have a governing body that's overseeing that in case something does go wrong.
Exactly. And that's valuable big time. Mm-hmm. So you said that the commission rates for agents have always been negotiable. And I understand that on paper, that's fact. But it seems to be that general public would know it as this 6% has been the floor. Where did that become the standard? Why has that become this huge source of attack if for any reason it actually was more easily negotiated?
Right. And, you know, a lot of thoughts gone into this. You know, I'm thinking maybe I should just Google what standard means. You know,
right, of course.
What does standard really mean?
Yeah, right. No, that's like normal.
Right.
What's normal?
Right. So, you know, there's different models out there. There's some models that do not provide buyer-side commission. I've seen commissions put into the MLS as low as 99 cents.
And what are those circumstances? That's when people are selling properties amongst family or?
Well, it's about competition. It's about different models and different brokerages. And one brokerage might charge a 6%, one might charge a 5%, one might charge 3% plus 99 cents.
Gotcha.
You know, it's hard to determine what model it is. In different markets, in hot markets, we generally see these discounters come out. And, you know, if you remember the buy owner a long time ago, I don't know if they're even in existence anymore, but they had a flat fee listing agreement. And so you paid a certain amount of money, and then they listed your house in the MLS, and then you had to do the rest. You had to show your own property, and then a buyer's agent would come in and possibly write an offer and negotiate their own commissions.
Mm-hmm.
So these models have been out there the entire time. I think that, you know, through competition, that we kind of seen what other people's models were, and we tried to stay close in line with those within different brokerages. And that's my opinion on why I think that the media got it wrong, I believe, and they said that the standard commission is 6%, because there is no standard.
Yeah, that's interesting, and that's why I'm asking, how did that get to be the case? So in a place like Sarasota, where we have been and don't seem to have any sign of ending soon, being such a hot real estate place, whether it's commercial or residential, how does it not get to be where the competition doesn't almost become negating itself, where we're just all doing 6% and no one's undercutting anybody? Since we know we're going to sell the product, why do 5%? Why do 4%? Why do anything less than 6? We know the property's going to sell.
Why not do 8?
Exactly. Isn't that kind of part of what the perceived problem is? So in an area like this, do you see the competition where people are starting to want to shave their commission points, or do you see it where, since we know it's going to sell, we just all hold 6?
Well, I've looked in the MLS, you know, I look for properties in the MLS all the time, and there's just various rates of compensation. And people are like, well, if I don't give 6% or if I don't give 3% to the buyer's side, then
right,
it's going to deter the agent from taking the buyers to the property.
Exactly.
And that's where the code of ethics steps in, because that's unethical for you as my buyer to come to me and say, I want to see this house, and I don't go and show it to you because they're not compensating me as much as I think that that my worth is. And so I think that, you know, I never steer anybody from anything, and I don't think that anybody out there is doing that. I think that when we build relationships with our customers, we might, you know, get paid 2% on this deal, but when they're going to sell their house, you know, we work out a different compensation package going forward. And if they maintain a relationship with me, this is a relationship throughout my entire career. And so I'm going to sell them their first house. Then they're going to either, you know, they're going to have kids, and then they're going to want to upgrade or get into different school districts and things like that. And so if I maintain that relationship with them, then I'm going to be able to sell that house for them and find them another one. So I think that people thinking that we were steering people to different in different directions because of compensation is probably far off.
It was probably just a minority that made
it might
the one bad apple, so to speak.
Right. You know, some people don't get out of bed for a certain amount of money, you know. But I'm a hustler, so I'm gonna show you everything.
So you mentioned that you're going to have to try to proposition your value in a more tangible way, for want of a better way of putting it. What do you think helps do that now, since you've been around this for so long? You know what makes a good realtor and what doesn't, and what makes a happy sale on both ends and what doesn't. Now that you have to kind of try to show those cards, what do you think people can do to try to show their value and not be like, hey, I'm just a guy that sold your house and I took 20 grand and out the door I go?
Well, showing your value, it's about paying attention to detail. There are certain timelines in the contract, and the contract's very important. When we write either the standard FAR bar contract, Florida bar contract, or the as-is contract, there's timelines within there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, escrow needs to be to the title agent in a certain amount of time. And, you know, we have loan approval periods. And if you pass your loan approval period, then there's consequences for that. And if you're a buyer and you're putting $10,000 into escrow, I feel responsible for your money. And my responsibility is to make sure that the timelines are all met so that you are not in jeopardy of losing your escrow deposit. That's one thing. There's several different tools out there. I believe in touch points. I believe that you have to go out there and you have to stay first in mind, because if you have, you know, we have 9,000 realtors here.
Right.
And so there's
literally 9,000.
Yeah, yeah. It's the truth. And that's more than all the listings that are out there. So, you know, somebody's going to starve in this environment. And you just have to set yourself apart from everybody else, because if you go ghost on the buyer that you worked with and they don't hear from you for 3 years or 4 years when they're getting ready to sell their house, they might select somebody else. So you make sure that you show value by following up with them, making sure, you know, we have a list of contractors. How's your house going? Well, I have this leaky sink, and I've been trying to get that fixed, but I can't find a person for that. Mm-hmm. You know, just a good opportunity for me to say, well, I have a list of 3 plumbers that have been very reliable in the past, and I can give those to you. Or, you know, when homestead exemption comes around in March, you know, just reminding them of those types of things. Different bills that are coming from legislation, like, you know, the house hardening bill that just happened through Live Local.
What's that?
They funded, so Live Local is has multiple components to it, and they funded $100 million into house hardening, which is, it's a tax-free opportunity for you to put new windows or a roof on your house and make it hurricane ready.
Ah, that's what I was thinking.
Right. And so when things like that come from legislation, and you know that somebody moved into a 1994 house or something like that, and mm-hmm. their windows are not upgraded, you could call them on the phone and say, have you ever heard about this program? So there's all kinds of value. There are all kinds of value propositions that you can think of to put in your toolbox to make sure that you're first in mind when it comes time for them to buy or sell.
That actually made me think of something interesting too. How much of it now has gotten to be programs like that are their conception is really based around the fact that the home insurance industry here has become so hairy. If we weren't in Florida where home insurance was such an issue, do you think something, a program like that would even exist? Or that $100 million is just out there because it's going to save someone $200 million on the back end?
Well, you know, nobody really wants to talk bad about lawyers, but I will. So the thing is that there's good players and there's bad players in the field. And
right.
So the reason that we're in this lawsuit is because we saw money involved, and that's, you know, litigation. And so the same thing happened with the insurance industry. We got hit hard by a few hurricanes.
Right.
That's obvious.
Too close.
Right. And so then there was attorneys that got involved, and they partnered up with roofing companies, and they went around and they said, okay, you're missing a couple shingles up here. We can get your whole roof replaced.
Ah.
And so there was, you know, the attorneys were making the most of the money. You know, to put a roof on a house is $10,000-$12,000, depending on
easy.
What the square footage is.
Yeah.
You know, but they were charging as much as $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000.
Good God.
And so the majority of the money was going to these attorneys. And so legislation stepped in and they capped it. They capped the amount of money that the attorney could get for these lawsuits.
Mm.
Which, you know, we had multiple insurers leave the state of Florida.
Big insurers.
Right. And we've actually just talked 7 of them back in.
Oh, so, yeah? How did that happen?
Well, you know, there's a lot of partnerships. You know, Jim Boyd is you know, our representative here, and he also runs an insurance company, so he knows the ins and outs of it.
Nice.
You know, and you know, talking people back into the state of Florida is also going to breed competition, which will hopefully bring down insurance cost, barring that we don't have, you know, another year of multiple hurricanes.
Right. That's the thing. It's just been it's just been this lose-lose proposition for insurance companies. Yeah. So then the state steps in with their insurance, and then how much of a complication does that make it for you and realtors in the area? That's really kind of where I was going with this, where you see a property where it's like you need a roof, you can't even insure this, your four-point inspection, your wind mitigation, you know what I mean?
That's where you become creative and you build partnerships with people. There are roof companies out there that will do your roof prior to closing and get paid at closing. A little bit risky. You know, because if it doesn't close, then I don't know how that works. I've used them in the past. That's providing realtor value, is knowing those relationships and having them available for when there is a roof that's over 15 years old. And we have a solution for it, so we can continue to move forward and sell your house. It's not a barrier anymore. And so there's so many opportunities just to show your value in that, for sure.
Yeah, because it is a tangled web in Florida, no doubt.
Yeah, but, you know, good luck this year, hopefully, with no hurricanes, and we get through this, and then our insurance rates start to come down, and affordability will follow.
Right, yep, we're due.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned relationships more than once, and I think that's a really important thing, because in transactional business, you can be transactional to people. You don't have to build those relationships. It seems like this is something you were probably good at before real estate. Can you talk to me a little bit about what building these personal relationships mean to you and how you go about doing it?
I think, you know, my personal relationship building started at the fire department as a paramedic, meeting with different, basically I got to meet new people every day at the fire department, you know, cause they'd call and I'd never met them before. And I show up at their house and it might be their worst moment ever. And so able to, you know, talk them through that and try to comfort them and give them the appropriate medical care and take them to the hospital. And you know, the other part about, the parallels to firefighting or real estate is problem solving. One, we have to problem solve. And when the bell goes off, you respond. And so when the phone rings, you know, they don't want to wait a week to see the property. They want to see it right now. So you have to make yourself available to those people. So I think that that's where the relationship building started. And then we put some systems in place to foster that throughout you know, the buying and selling process, and then also to maintain relationships with these people for years to come.
That's very cool. So I know we started this one a little bit untraditional. I want to press rewind a little bit. How do you get into firefighting and EMS? What is the cotter pin for that one?
All right. So I grew up in a town in Illinois called Ridge Farm. And as you can understand, it was a farm on a ridge. We had 1,000 people there. You know, I was really into agriculture at the time. I worked on a pig farm.
Awesome.
And so, you know, that's where I thought I was going to be. I thought I was going to be a pig farmer. And so I, you know, I joined the Army and,
like right out of high school.
Yeah. Right out of high school. And when I went into the Army, they set you down. You take an ASVAB test,
yep.
And then they give you like 3 MOSs to choose from. And one was combat engineer, where you build a bridge and blow it up, which that didn't make sense to me. You know, why would you blow up something that you just made? And then the other one was infantry, which we definitely need our infantry guys. But they had this one video of these guys jumping out of helicopters and, you know, saving people on the ground. And that was a combat medic. And I was like, that's thrilling. That's what I want to do.
Nice.
And so that was my start. And then when I, you know, I was a medic for 3 years in active duty and then 5 years in the reserves. And so when I came to Florida, I didn't want to go back to Illinois. It's too cold there.
Right.
So when I came to Florida and I saw palm trees and the great beaches and stuff, I said, this is home. And so I went to the local school here and got my state Florida paramedic license. And that's how it all began.
And you came to Sarasota first, or this area first?
I came to Bradenton Beach.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, it's an infectious spot when you come here.
Yeah.
Okay, so how long did you spend doing EMS here?
30 years.
30 years here doing EMS?
Yeah.
So were you doing EMS and real estate alongside one another
parallel.
For a while?
Yep.
Okay, so how does that work? Those are interesting plates to juggle simultaneously.
Yeah, it is interesting because you firefighters generally work a 24, 48-hour shift. And so you have 24 hours where you're at the fire department and 48 hours when you're off.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these guys, they have different trades because if not, you're really going to get bored in your 48 hours that you're off work.
Hmm.
So, you know, a lot of them do tile work or they do cabinets, lawn maintenance, pool maintenance, that kind of stuff. And
gig work you can pop in and out of.
Right. And for some reason, I got directed into real estate.
So, how does that happen?
Well, I was very fascinated by buying and selling properties, investments in real estate, and so when I was I bought my first house here for $55,000. I mean, you can't even buy a car for that.
You can't get a shoebox for that here.
No, and so and I sold it probably for about $129,000. You know, and I was like, there's value in here. You know, it's like. More wealth has been built in the United States through real estate than any other wealth that I know of, besides maybe the stock market. But, you know, and I was like, I like the concept of buying and selling properties and investing in them. And so I said, well, there's another avenue here. I could get my real estate license and start working as a realtor. And then, then I'd have a side hustle also. Well, the side hustle turned into the major job, and my fire department career was like, you know, something that at certain points you're like, you know, where am I going to make the money? But I really do love what I'm doing. So I kept it all together for 20 years and retired from the fire department 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, man, that is a lot to juggle. So it was really just the two passions running side by side, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the relationship, you know, it doesn't hurt to have relationships with a bunch of firefighters and law enforcement officers and nurses.
Right.
Because, you know, those people realize that you're in real estate and they are all could be your customers potentially at some point. And so that's... Part of the things that I talk to new realtors that I'm mentoring is that you have to get out there and you have to join some type of club or you have to be part of something so that you can have your sphere of influence so that you can sell properties to them.
Did the military help you feel that way because everybody has to be interconnected, or was that just something you just innately picked up on from your experience of being around?
Oh, there's a lot of good things that happened to me in the military. I probably would have went down the wrong path if I didn't go there. I mean, that taught me responsibility. It taught me situational awareness.
Right.
It taught me how to be a man. You know, and things are hard sometimes, but you know, I didn't want to continue in that military path because I felt like it was restrictive, and it is. You know, you can only make as much money as your rank.
Right.
I've always felt like I classified myself the other day as a serial entrepreneur. You know,
love that.
I'm always starting, new, I always have new ideas, new concepts and things like that. So I was felt like I was a little bit held back in the military. But when I got into the civilian world, it was so much easier to have ideas and do your own thing and not be, kind of stifled.
Right. So when you're doing the EMS thing and the real estate thing at the same time, a lot of people would say, well, you can't have a plan B because it just sacrifices plan A. Did you really see those things as like two plan A?
Yes, I did. And, you know, there's a lot, you know, real estate's each one of these agents are a business of their own. You know, they're independent contractors. Mm-hmm. So they may work as an employee of a brokerage, but they actually have to maintain their own business. And so when you're maintaining your own business, then you have to have certain business practices. And that's why, you know, National Association of Realtors comes out with the stats that says 87% of all people that graduate this class are out within the first 5 years, 87%. Turnover. That's a huge turnover rate. That means 13% remain.
Wow. What do you think attributes that? Just the sheer number of people, just the sheer competition of it all?
HGTV, maybe? I don't know. So, you know, it's like all these shows came out and that people watch these shows and they say, oh, wow, that's easy.
Well, you were actually around in that turning point. Was that a really noticeable turning point? People started getting into this for leisure?
Well, you know, there's various reasons that people get into it. Some people are investors, and if they're investing, then they save themselves in commission. Some people just want to sell a couple houses a year, and they're okay with that as a part-time gig, as they're retired or something like that. And then people really get involved in it and want to make this is what feeds their families.
Right.
So there's different variations of it. But when, you know, you have shows where – you know, everybody's getting together at 9 a.m. drinking mimosas and in these big fancy houses, then you think, I could do that too.
Right.
Right? So, and then they get into it, and they're like, oh, it's not what I thought it was going to be. And so then, you know, because not everybody has the entrepreneurial spirit.
True.
They sometimes fall short. And if they fall short, it's probably because there was lack of leadership or lack of information. Lack of information before I started this journey, and I got into that class. I wish there was some kind of pre-licensing informational session that you could talk to people about and say, it probably isn't a good idea to waste your money on this because you don't have the right mindset. Or I can redirect you and say, if you want to be successful in this business, these are the things that you're going to have to do. Are you ready to do that? And if you say yes, then proceed with the class.
Do you think that's one of the cons of how low the barrier of entry is to do this at a rudimentary level?
I think the barrier of entry is low, which it's actually not that low because 50% of the people that take the test for the first time fail it.
Right.
So it's a hard test.
Yeah.
But I think that what we're lacking at this point is that we need to raise the bar going forward, and so we need to have, you know, if you're an appraiser, that's a 2-year internship before you can even start appraising properties. Maybe we need to implement some of that, some more hardcore mentorship for the people that are coming out of these schools so that they learn the trade the right way.
Do you see anybody do that?
Oh, yeah. There's, you know, there's a lot of good agencies out there that are coaching their, you know, a lot of good brokerages out there coaching their people.
So there again, there's just a million different ways to skin this cat and everybody's.
Right. And then there's some brokerages out there that I call them collectors of agents. You know, they're just collecting hundreds of agents and, you know, they're getting a fee from those agents every month and that's cool with them. But that's not what it's about. You know, we have a responsibility to this industry to be top notch and show our value and professionalism. And so if that's not your interest, then it's probably not the business for you.
Do you see that being exacerbated or even more so in a place like the Sarasota, Bradenton area where our influx of people here is just, I mean, even nationally speaking, we're way off the charts?
Oh, we're way off the charts. I mean, it's still a hotbed here. From here to Fort Myers, these beaches are bringing people in from all kinds of different places because COVID kind of changed that for us.
Yeah.
COVID changed the way that we work. You know, a lot of people don't even have to report to an office anymore. They work from home. And so why not work in Florida when it's nice and sunny every day instead of going to Omaha where I was just at? Right. And it was 24 degrees and it was 80 when I left here. So, you know, that's a no-brainer. So people are coming in influxes and that's good, and it's good for our economy. I mean, we have a really good economy here. And I think we're still going to see they estimate about 1,200 people a day coming into the state of Florida.
Phew.
And so and somebody even said, I think an economist said it equates to about $2 million of an hour of funds that are coming into the state of Florida.
Good God.
So that's good for the economy, but it's not good for the infrastructure because traffic's getting bad and things like that. But I'm not moving.
Yeah, I'm not either. Would you say that COVID was really the tipping point for that? Because, I mean, we've always had these beaches. You've been here quite a while. I've been here quite a while. I mean, it's been paradise here since the Ringling decided to put his spot out there.
I do believe it had a factor in it. It had a factor in a lot of things. And it had a factor in real estate because, first of all, we had to become essential. And the good thing was the governor, he said that we were essential employees. And so we were able to still perform and work during COVID. You know, we just had different rules. And that's another thing. When we first started talking about real estate and the evolution of real estate, we adapted and overcome that moment. And so...
So you didn't skip a beat there really at all?
We didn't. And what happened is builders stopped building during that time. And so then we got a little bit behind on inventory.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course.
And so when we got behind on inventory, then, it was a frenzy to, the sky is falling. We have to get a house right now. So there was multiple offers on everything.
Right.
Drove the prices up pretty significantly. And now we have an affordability problem here. And coupled with interest rates and insurance. And so those three factors are making these houses that used to be affordable to just, regular folks around here, it's hard for them to find a place. And so I wish we probably could have pushed interest rates up a little bit sooner, and it might have slowed down all the buyers coming into the market.
You're right.
And then we would have more inventory, and then we would have lower price points for people, but that didn't happen. So here we are.
So which of those three factors, if any, do you see giving way or changing at all, or is this just the new norm you feel, and we're heading this way, one-way road now?
Right. My crystal ball is broken.
Yeah.
So, I've made predictions in the past, and I don't really have one at this point. I do know that I believe that the competition within the insurance industry will drive prices down. We've seen high insurance rates before in the past. We've seen high interest rates before in the past.
Yeah, actually much higher than this.
Right. I mean, the average over a 30-year period was like 7.8% or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, in the 80s, it was over 15 at points.
84, 85, I think it was 18.6 at
one point. Yeah.
So that will always fluctuate. And, will prices come down a little bit? I predict they probably will, We're seeing inventory on the market a little bit longer, and when that happens and you have more inventory out there to choose from, then buyers have a better opportunity to negotiate with the sellers. And so we are seeing price drops happen more frequently than we did in the past because they're only on the market for 5 minutes.
Right.
So you can't drop a price if it's only on the market for a short time.
Right. So, I know your crystal ball is broken, but so do you think that we can sustain this type of influx of people here? I was actually watching a video yesterday that was saying that the national economy isn't really doing all that great. It's just that certain pockets are really picking it up, and actually the state of Florida was the highest one. And you mentioned things like the infrastructure, and we do have 9,000 realtors in this area, literally. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this kind of stuff is sustainable, or we might be on teeter of cannibalize? Because you've been around long enough. You've seen some of these ebbs and flows.
Right. Well, I don't know why we couldn't – why we didn't identify the housing crisis back in 2006. I know, why didn't we see that? We were giving away money.
What do you think the kink in the slinky was there, though? Was it the appraising or?
No, I don't think it was the appraising. It was, getting caught in a interest-only loan that was going to convert in 3 years to something with a higher interest rate, much higher interest rate. And when those converted, there was a promise to these people that, hey, we'll be able to refinance you out of this and we'll get you into a different loan package.
Mm.
So what happened is the prices started going down and the banks weren't going to loan on the property because the appraised values were coming in lower than what they had paid for them. And so they couldn't get out of these loans into a better package. And so when that changed, people's payments went exorbitantly through the roof. High.
Yeah.
So I think that that was the problem. But why didn't we see that? I don't know. That hindsight's 20/20.
Of course. So what do you think though? Going forward, do we have some of these things? Because people talk like we're on a housing crisis and an affordability crisis. I mean, we do have some unique things here, just that everything is so ridiculously expensive. That's why I'm wondering, are these things going to be more sustainable, you know, or are we going to have to see a flight backwards to when normal people can own homes again and insurance isn't?
I don't know if, I'm not sure how to fix it. I know that they've changed some density laws so that builders, if they're going to build in a certain percentage of affordable housing, that their density is less. You know, they can build more houses on smaller pieces of property, or they can build more stories on condominiums and things if they're offering a certain amount of affordable housing. You know, that's one step in the right direction. What I also think is that we have to think about these loan packages. You know, your standard loan package for conventional FHA, VA is 30 years. So in 30 years, and I don't know if this has happened. I just brainstorm a little bit.
Right.
But, you know, you take 30 years to repay a loan, and over that amount of time, you pay more interest than you do principal on that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's out of control. So, you know, maybe we extend the amount of time that it takes somebody to pay that loan back. Maybe we extend it to 40 years, and then that makes it a little bit more affordable. Because, you know, I see a lot of people that are 80 years old or 90 years old buying properties, and I don't expect them to be able to pay off their loan in the next 30 years.
Right.
I mean, good for them if they live to be 120.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But, you know, they're all lendable. We don't discriminate against that. So why haven't we thought a way through this? And I think that they, you know, a lot of the builders now are offering incentives. And so they will buy down your rates, which is good, you know. And then there's...
What do you mean by that?
So, you know, you pay points towards your interest rates, and so whatever the point cost to buy down that 1% or whatever, then you pay an extra amount of money.
Okay.
And sometimes the builders will take care of that. And we can get creative as far as, you know, the sellers actually buying down rates as a closing cost incentive to the buyers. There's all types of opportunities out there, and there's a lot of people that are a lot smarter than me that are working on that right now. So, you know, I think we're going to get there. We have to get there. I mean, there's no you think about it, when I came here in 1991, every job was $5 an hour, right?
Yeah.
So now we've set the minimum wage bar, and I think it's up to 15 now or something like that. That's still not going to get anybody into housing. A lot of people are living together. A lot of families are actually, you know, doing multi-generational housing now, things like that. So we just have to think outside of the box, and because if we don't, we're going to lose a lot of people here that can't afford to live here. And those are essential people. These are the people that work in your restaurants, the people that work in the hospitals, the firefighters and paramedics. They don't make a great deal of money. So we have to do something, because, you know, we are not going to be able to be catered to here if we don't have those essential workers taking care of the general public.
Do you see that happening already?
I've seen, you know, certain restaurants and things like that. People are, you know, migrant workers, things like that, moving out of the area because sometimes based on law, sometimes based on environment and being able to live. But I've seen some good corporations that are coming in and saying, hey, we want to stay here in Florida, so we're going to build a housing community for the people that work in our industry. And I think that you know, you're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah, and that's actually common overseas and in other parts of the country too. So mm-hmm. That would be, at least there's some proof of concept out there for that.
Right.
What do you see as some of, I know we've kind of gone through a little bit of the nitty gritty and the challenges that are out there, but what do you see as some of the most positive things we have on the horizon, not only for realtors and the ease, for want of a better way of putting it, of doing a real estate transaction, but for the environment as a whole around here where we have this momentum?
Oh, we have good momentum right now. We have a lot of good support. There's a lot of good projects that are happening right here in this community. A lot of people have initiatives going on for, you know, clean water. If you look at, you know, the Players Theaters that's going in, and Moat Marine, and a bunch of other things, they're really studying how we can clean the water up and return it back out into the Gulf of Mexico. So there's a lot of good initiatives going on for that. You know, there's people that are trying to redevelop some oyster beds here. A lot of smart people move here to Manatee, Sarasota counties, and they're doing good work. And so we're also, I don't know if these roundabout things are working, but I talk to people that love them, and then I talk to people that hate them. And some people say that it makes the traffic flow better, and it's better for the environment because people aren't sitting at a light for a certain amount of time.
Oh, true,
true. So there's a lot of good things on the horizon here. A lot of good companies are coming into our area, and it's going to make things better.
Do you see, and that just reminded me of something, do you see a lot of transitioning from people in homes to condos and apartments?
No, condominiums are a whole another can of worms right now.
Yeah.
Especially with the Surfside collapse that happened in Miami, which basically has created legislation for certain milestone inspections to be done on condominiums, certain budgets for reserves to be met with these condominium associations. So a lot of change has happened in the condo market. But if you look at living in a single family home,
mm-hmm.
and you have an HOA,
mm-hmm.
and you might have a CDD.
So which had become really common now?
Right.
Okay.
Right, because then the infrastructure can be done on a bond, and then it's paid back by the people that live in the neighborhood over a period of time.
Understood.
So with the condominiums now, the condominiums are becoming a little less affordable, because now you have your payment, and then you have your association dues, and then you might even have special assessments on top of that. Plus, insurance has gone up on these condominiums, and so everybody has to we're spreading it out. You know, everybody's going to have to pay for the insurance on the condominium that lives in that building.
Right.
And so I've seen some people getting priced out of condos.
It's just a wild west on this coast, huh?
Yes, it is. And you know, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of problems to solve, but there's a lot of good solutions that are coming down the pike.
And thankfully, we've got a lot of natural beauty here, and
oh, absolutely.
People paying attention to it.
Yeah.
Well, let's try to get you out of here on something fun.
Okay.
If you could wave a wand and make one ethical standard for the Realtor Association, or maybe change one rule that your realtors work under that you feel would open the floodgates more and let this more flourish, if you could be the man with the button, what button are you pushing?
Oh, wow. How many buttons do I got? Just one?
Well, you can have one B.
One B.
One and one B.
I just, we talked about the barrier entry, and there's a lot of people that are interested in becoming real estate agents. And so we have, locally in our area, we have about 120 people apply every month.
Dang.
To work in our field. And so with that, I would like to wave the wand that says we mandate a mentorship program for these people as they come out of school. I don't know what it looks like. I just know that it's necessary. I know that people get out of school and they're lost. And, you know, I think that the Realtor Association needs to show their value. And maybe after COVID, we took our foot off the gas a little bit because
everything was easy and crazy.
Nobody showed up. You know, the building was closed.
Gotcha.
You know, and then we started getting back into some kind of routine, and we have to evolve, we have to be creative, we have to think outside of the box, we have to make sure that we provide products and services to our realtors. And somehow I would like to see that mentorship program be put in place by the association statewide or locally, so that we can continue to make sure that 87% of these people don't fail.
Right. This may be an obvious follow-up to this, but I kind of want to get it on the books. Do you feel that the mentorship, the invaluable nature of having a mentorship, something like that, is that you can share the experience, and the experience is just simply something that can't be taught?
That's true in anything, though.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if you feel that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so many facets to it. And I'll just give you an example. You know, Mosaic owns a lot of mineral rights out in Miyaki City.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're selling property out in maybe off Clay Gully Road, if you don't have the experience to know that that property does not come with the mineral rights, and you can't build on that, or you can't improve it anymore, because there were 67 homes built out there at one time, and then the county finally stopped it because of an order that came through the courts from Mosaic. And now these houses are sitting out here, and they can't get any permits to add on or whatever. So if somebody comes to me as a seller and says, I want to sell my house out in the Keys track of Mosaic, then I know from my experience that you can't do certain things out there. You can't build additional buildings and things like that. You know, septic tanks, wells, there's, you know, various different things that happen out in East County. And then there's also coastal things that you have to think about. You know, somebody specializes in selling coastal property, that's a mentor right there that you need to attach yourself to if you want to sell coastal property. If you want to sell in Miyaki, then you need to get a rural property specialist. So, yeah, there's a lot of facets to the business that you just don't know about until you get in it. And sometimes you have to learn them the hard way, like I did.
Well, I think being a realtor Padawan would be cool.
Yeah.
No shame in that.
No.
Well, Tony, I really appreciate you coming down, man. I'm very grateful for you sharing all your insight and your experience. And it was a lot of information, and I can't thank you enough for coming down.
All right, brother. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.